now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain! Back to the House of Pain!
Everyone, and welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast. From classes to cults, all the cheese in between. The movies might be B, but the entertainment is grade A. And I'm your host, Jason Giaconetti. I hope everyone enjoyed the last podcast where my dad and I looked at The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Today, I'm going to be looking at 1978's Piranha. And we'll get to that right after this.
Who could have imagined they were there? Who could have predicted they would attack? And now, who would survive? Piranha, they're here. Piranha, they're hungry.
What's the matter with you?
Piranha, they're unstoppable.
Stop that!
Hey. Keep your hand out of the water.
What's wrong with the water?
The water is filled with carnivorous fish.
Piranha. They call them the devil fish because wherever they go, hell waits below.
They breed like flies. There'll be no way to stop them.
Suddenly, no one is safe. And everyone must be warned. The water is now a human death trap.
Two people have been killed up there, and more have been killed all along the river.
You gotta believe us.
These are the man-eaters who go beyond the bite of all other jaws. Sharks come alone. Piranha come in thousands. Crazed by the scent of blood, they live by the taste of flesh. With razor teeth, they can strip a man to the bone in a frozen instant of terror. Piranha. They're here. They're hungry. They'll eat you alive. Who can stop them?
Piranha was released August 3rd, 1978, with an approximate running time of 95 minutes. It was directed by Joe Dante. That's a name that's familiar for some of us, you know, movies like Gremlins and such. And it was produced by John Davis, Keiko von Lewin, and more importantly, Roger Corman. This is the first in our Roger Corman series of things we're going to be talking about. You'll hear his name a lot. Story by John Sayles and Richard Robinson. Distributed by New World Pictures in the U.S. and United Artists internationally. Now, New World Pictures is Roger Corman's picture house. The budget is anywhere between several reports saying $660,000 to $770,000, but it made about $16 million, and that's one of the things we haven't talked about Corman a lot in this show yet, but Roger Corman was really good at taking a small amount of money, sending a crew of young directors and actors and people who became famous later on, and they made quality little pictures that made a lot of money for him. Our stars are Bradford Dillman. Some of you might remember him from Escape from Planet of the Apes. He was Dr. Lewis Dixon. I actually remember him from The Enforcer, the Dirty Harry movie where he played Captain McKay. Heather Mendes, who played Louisa in The Sound of Music. That's probably the biggest credit on her thing. She also was in the movie as Christina Stoner. Kevin McCarthy, of course. Kevin McCarthy from one of my favorite movies, maybe one of my top five movies of all time, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He was also in Inner Space, UHF, you name it. Keenan Wynn, you know, he probably, most people know him from Dr. Strangelove and maybe Once Upon a Time in America. And then the usuals, Dick Miller, Barbara Steele, those kind of people, faces that you recognize as you go through. Couple of, you know, looking at like Paul Bartlett, guys like that who they became, TV, necessarily, they were TV actors or they were actors in these type of movies. And if you like these kind of movies, you definitely saw them a lot. One of the things, folks, I know I was talking about this with the guys off air on The Vault the other day. I'm not a huge fan of doing like the run through of the whole movie, but it's kind of hard to have a discussion about the movie as I'm doing a run through by myself. So I'm going to give you a brief run through and then I'll kind of hit the things I want to talk about. Now I might stop during the run through and throw in some pieces of information as we go. In the future, I think Dad and I are going to be doing a lot more of, as we're going through the movie, maybe talking about it as we go through, the whole way through this, instead of me just ripping off exactly what happens. Because the assumption being, obviously, some of you might actually be watching this movie before we actually talk about it. But our story opens as David and Barbara are two young backpackers who happen upon a military post that seems to be abandoned. They discover a large man-made reservoir and decide to go skinny dipping. Now, I'm just going to throw this out there. At this point, my daughter and my wife watched this recently with me. My daughter's 5. Some of you have heard her on this show before. And she's yelling at them, "Don't go in there! You know there's piranha!" And I said, "Haley, they don't know. Just calm down." So she yelled at the movie a lot. Where were we? Okay, so they discover the reservoir and they go skinny dipping. So they get naked, they get in, and something attacks them. Okay, and they start screaming, and that alerts someone who's still inside the military base. So what happens is Maggie, who's a skip tracer, I had no idea what a skip tracer was. It turns out it's an investigator who's hired by Barbara's parents to go find their daughter. Funny fact right there, the game she's playing is Jaws. You'll hear more about Jaws as we go. So her employer, sends her up the mountain to go find the kids. So she actually seeks out Paul Grogan. Now, Paul Grogan, that's Bradford Dillman, he's living in a cabin there. It's clear that his wife has left him. He has a daughter, we learn, who's at summer camp down the mountain. But we don't learn too much more. In the novelization of this, John Sayles, who actually wrote this and then was in the movie later on as an MP, it goes much more in detail about his wife leaving him and stuff because he's an alcoholic. It's clear he's an alcoholic. He is clearly an alcoholic. When they bring the supplies to him, he's got all this liquor. It's just liquor coming in, and that's what he's got. While he's eating his fish, he fills his canteen with liquor. Anyway, so Maggie convinces Paul, after some doing, to go up to the military base to look for the kids. While they're at the military base, Paul tastes the water and says it's salty, which kind of he wasn't expecting. So they start exploring the complex, looking around. So Maggie thinks maybe they both drowned in the pond, and so she decides to drain the pond. So as she flips on the switch, Kevin McCarthy's character, here's Dr. Hoke, comes out, and he tries to stop them from draining the pond. He's knocked unconscious during the whole thing, and as Maggie and Paul go outside and see the empty pond, they see the bones of what's David and Barbara. Now, they're not sure. At first, they think it might be a dog or whatever, but clearly, there are just bones in the bottom. And everything that was in that man-made pond, reservoir, whatever you call it, has all been now released back into the river. So, when the mysterious man tries to steal the Jeep, he crashed it. And my daughter, funny, she goes, "Daddy, he cannot drive." And I said, "Well, honey, it's a movie." But the Jeep just completely just rolls over. It's a mess. Anyway, so he's knocked out there again. They go back to Paul's cabin where Dr. Hoke is rambling about Razor Tooth. But anyway, in the morning, they load the old man. Now, they don't have the raft, so they don't have the Jeep. So they have a log raft that Paul Grogan is is Bradford Dillman's character. His daughter and him had built during the summer because they read Huck Finn. So they put him on the homemade raft, and they start setting downstream. And Dr. Hook wakes up and during this, and he tells them that they've done something really terrible. And the pond was a breeding ground for mutant piranha, which he developed for the Vietnam War. Now, this is 1978, so Vietnam's not that long ago, and clearly the base had been shut down, so he had developed it for that. It's just part of the whole story of what's going on there, and you'll see more of that when we get further in. And that the military pulled his funding on the operation, but he remained and still experimented on it even after it was shut down. So the piranha now, they're in the river, and they claim his, they wound up claiming Paul's friend Jack. Now Jack is the one who brings in the liquor and bringing. That's how we know Grogan's an alcoholic. And his dog is barking, and it winds up chewing up his legs, and he winds up bleeding to death. And they dock there and they find him. Downstream, as this is happening, a father and son are out fishing on the river. Now the dad feels they're snagged on something. He goes to unsnag the canoe, and winds up going into the drink, and the piranha eat him as the son scrambles on top. Now, originally, in the movie we have now, the cut that's available, the son appears to have nothing happened to him, but he's really clearly traumatized by this, and there were parts cut out where he was like kind of cut up and whatever, but again, the son escapes, and he's sitting on top of the canoe. So Paul's especially concerned now after, as they're coming down, that his daughter Susie, who's at the camp downriver, as the piranha are heading that way. Also downstream is the new Lost Lake Resort, which is opening. And both Maggie and Grogan try to frantically call both the camp and the resort, and both dismiss it as him being crazy. Actually, the camp director says, "You're drunk," you know, which is just funny. As my daughter, again, young screen, she goes, "He's telling the truth. Why doesn't anyone believe him?" I feel like that's a theme we're going to hear. So as they head downriver, they come upon the boy in the capsized boat, and they can't get him off there. So Dr. Hoke actually sacrifices himself going into the river to help save the boy, and he's wounded now, and he's killed, mortally wounded. They bring him aboard, and what happens is now he's dripping, his blood is dripping into it, seeping through into the river, and they're going to begin to attack the raft, and they end up biting all the moorings and stuff, and start taking it apart, because the raft was built like a raft would have been built back in Huck Finn's time. There's no nails together, it's just lashed together. So as the raft becomes now non-operable, as they get to the side and Grogan and the boy and Maggie are all safe, Grogan then goes on a full sprint, like full-on Jesse Owens, you know, going on a full sprint to get to the dam. Because he knows that if they get to the dam and they don't release them through, that what happen is that the piranha will be stopped and they won't be able to get down to the downriver to the lake and to the resort. Now, he was able to stop the attendant from, at the last second, he's able to stop the attendant from actually releasing the dam. But then the military shows up, which kind of seems not weird at all. I mean, it makes sense here, but it kind of them seems like, okay. So he stops it. They call the military. The military team's led by Colonel Waxman and former Razortooth scientist Dr. Mengers. That's Barbara Steele, by the way. And they start feeding poison. Well, they don't believe him at first. So they throw a giant, what looks like it's got to be a leg of lamb or something into there. Kind of reminds me of the scene in Jaws. Shockingly, like the scene in Jaws. And they come back to all police. So they use Rote Note, which now, for those Creature to Black Lagoon fans out there, we know Rote Note very well, right? They put Rote Note on the water to kind of kill what's there. But what happens is they notice that on the map, there's a way around the dam. There's a distributary around the dam. So Waxman and Mengers decide that they need to quarantine, quote-unquote, both Paul and Maggie to have them not spread this. They're trying to keep this under control, and we'll see why that is in a minute. So they're, you know, placed under, quote-unquote, arrest. They're kind of held in a tent, and then they escape through kind of the silliest means in a while. But they manage to escape and steal a Jeep. Now, the law enforcement is informed. They get pulled over, and they're taken to jail. And now, when they're in jail, they manage to escape there with, if you thought the first time was crazy, this is pretty crazy, too. Especially since she has to take the sheriff or the deputy's pants off to get the keys because they're stuck. And Grogan's, "I thought you'd be faster getting a man's pants off than that," and which I found funny. My wife found funny. My daughter thought it was funny that she had to take his pants off. She didn't understand the double entendre there, which is totally fine. She's five. But she thought it was funny that they hit him with part of the toilet and then took his pants off. Anyway, so they steal the squad car, and they're now flying. And I mean flying. And there are scenes of them just absolutely almost killing themselves and catching air, like Dukes of Hazzard style air, as they're on their way down to the summer camp. Now, of course, we know there's no way in the world that all the fish were poisoned there, and that, and obviously Grogan seeing that there was a bypass around the dam, you know that they're going to the summer camps, and that's where they went, down to the summer camp, and they attacked them during the during their summer games, and everyone's in the water except Grogan's daughter, because she's terrified of the water. She's afraid things will get her. Now, obviously, she doesn't know there's piranha in the water, but she's still afraid, and that's why she's on the side. And if you start seeing counselors and students being murdered, Susie, who's Grogan's daughter, bravely tries to rescue her friends, which are Betsy and Laura. Those are the two counselors. Now, one of them gets killed, and she, Laura is able to get on, but Betsy, who's the one who's been really looking out for Susie, she gets pulled under, and the scene under the water where they pull her away, you see her face and then you see her get dragged away, shot later on in actually in a pool or a tank later after they did pickups and stuff like that. It's a very effective scene because you see her get yanked away, and it gives you a real sense, and the music actually really good at this point too. Paul and Maggie arrive at the camp too late, but once they know Susie's all right, they race off to the resort. Now, the owner of the resort is a guy named Buck Gardner. You know him as Dick Miller. I'm going to tell you this right now. Dick Miller is that guy you know. You know Dick Miller. I don't know Dick Miller. I don't know who that is, Jay. You do. Mr. Futterman from Gremlins. Any other number of movies he's been in. Dick Miller is that guy. That guy I know. Oh, I know that guy. In fact, I think there's a documentary called That Guy Dick Miller. And it's all about that. He's been around a long time. He's a Corman staple. He's one of those character actors that I love seeing in things. He's in The Howling. He's the bookshop owner, stuff like that. It's all those different things, like those little parts he plays that he, because he just lends that, you know, air of it being realistic. He's a great, like, realistic kind of actor. He's not, you know, he's not over the top Shatner or anything like that. But he, you know, he definitely lends some realism there. Now, he really doesn't want to hear anything about piranha, because he's trying to sell people to come buy into the Lost Lake and the whole thing. And he refuses to answer any phone calls and stuff like that. We now see that Dr. Mengers and Colonel Waxman show up there. Now, it is obvious at this point now that there's some involvement here going on between Waxman and Gardner and something about the Lost Lake, because he's an investor in the whole thing. And once we see that, it makes perfect sense why they want to shut this all down and why they didn't want to, you know, take a chance evacuating anything. You don't want to take a chance at your grand opening having something bad happen. So, needless to say, the piranha make it there and all heck break loose. So, one of my favorite scenes, the guy's water skiing and he can tell something's wrong in the water. And he's telling them to go faster, and they're like, "Go slower, no, go." And the two young ladies driving this boat, I mean, clueless, doesn't even come, you know, cut it. Sometimes they finally speed up, they slow down, whatever. Well, all I know is, at one point, you wind up having a guy in a motorboat almost get his head taken off by the rope. He jumps over. There's fire. People are getting killed. And one of the things I pointed out to my wife when we were watching this was, when you look at the beaches as now in Jaws, when everyone's doing the shark attacks and they're trying to get out of the water, you know, people are running, grabbing children, but they're at a beach. This Lost Lake is clearly some man-made thing, because there's a clear concrete edge to people are trying to pull people up onto, and their beach goes right up to the concrete edge, which I thought was just really funny. As you see all the different things, you know, going on, people are getting chewed up and killed and stuff. It's just great. I'll talk more about the effects in a minute. I should talk about it here. Why not? I can do what I want to do. The piranha effects were not the highest end budget-wise, but they are really effective. And we're talking about really basically piranha, like these fake piranha into sticks, just being wiggled really fast. But the sound that they make, the use of music, everything here just works really, really well. So, obviously, we're getting here closer to the end here, because something's got to happen, right? So, what happens is no one has a way to stop these things, and the piranha are eating the guests, you know, kind of thing. So Paul and Maggie are trying to figure it out. Paul says, you know, there's a smelting plant here, and it's underwater, which he was kind of hoping it wasn't. He was going to release all of the whatever was left in the pipes into it, and it'll kill everything. So him and Maggie borrow a boat, go out, and he ties a rope around his waist and says, count to 100. That's about as long as I can hold my breath. I'm going to try to open up the going in through the thing and open it up and kill everything in there. Now, when they start counting to 100, and this is something, now I know my dad's not in this episode, but I know this bothered him. The counting to 100 just didn't, there's no continuity how quickly they're counting or how slowly they're counting. There's no way in the world. He jumps in, he has to break in through like the window. Now get the dirt, and now of course the pipe won't turn, it's rusted shut, so he's underwater turning this thing, so he's now struggling. So if you think you can hold your breath up to the count of 100, right, of just like 1, 2, that kind of count to 100, now imagine trying to struggle turning a giant pipe, trying to release this stuff into the water. It doesn't, again, I'm willing to accept everything at this point. I'm willing to accept this as well. But of course, the piranha are coming, and they start biting him and eating his back. And when Maggie hits 100, the pipe opens up. Maggie hits 100, slams down the accelerator, and yanks him right out. Just through the rest of the window, through the rest of the wall, right out. Drags him out. And of course, once they get to the surface, they pull the rope up, and it's cut. It's not there. He's not at the end of the rope. And she's like, oh no, he's dead. Well, here comes his hand sticking up. And they bring him in, and he's clearly in shock, and he's all chewed up, but he released all the stuff from the smelting plant, all the residual stuff in the tubes, and it winds up killing all the piranha, or so we think. So it winds up saying, okay, we've killed everything, we've saved it. Now, the news reporter comes and says to Dr. Mengers, well, is there any chance? He goes, no, there's no chance. And plus, they can't live in salt water, and they can't. It's becomes like it's so clear at the end that this was being set up to possibly be a sequel, but it doesn't matter. It's a great ride. It's loads of fun. I can honestly say it is really different than the kind of movies we've covered so far in this show. Nothing comes close to something like this. This is totally 1978. Let's exploit the fact that Jaws had come out. Jaws 2, I think, was 1978 as well. You know, kind of thing. And this movie plays up. There's a little bit of nudity in here. There's definitely a lot of blood. It's a very different kind of film than, let's say, Them or It Came Beneath the Sea or the, you know, Beast in 20,000 Fathoms. But it is truly one of those B movies that a lot of us saw growing up. And you might have seen it on, let's say, like WOR, WPIX, WNYW. That's where we saw it. And it might have been cut to ribbons. And eventually you sought it out, or you got it at the mom and pop movie video store or whatever. And you watch it and you're like, and at no point are you like, wow, you might think certain things are idiotic or dumb, but you're not bored. This is not a movie where you're sitting there going, wow, when's this going to be over? This is boring. The one thing this is not boring. So one of the things that we were thinking here is, and I said this, the piranha were just rubber piranha attached to the end of sticks, and they were wiggling them off screen. It's highly effective. If you get a chance to see the documentary that goes along with it, they explain all this. It is outstanding to see what they did on such a small budget. And I think that's one of the things that we've keeps talking about here. These B movies, they didn't have the killer budgets. They didn't have the huge money budgets to do these things. But, you know, that's part of why these movies work. Now, give you an idea. Like, the extras in the movie, they were all paid $5 and given a box lunch. You think that flies today? You think that's going to fly in 2016? Yeah, I don't think so, right? So, but that's the kind of, you know, Poverty Row movie making they were doing, and Roger Corman was the king of that. So, again, I've mentioned, I'll just kind of hit this. We're going to talk about this now. So, I've mentioned Jaws a whole bunch here. And at the end of the last episode, I mentioned that a little person by the name of Steven Spielberg, you know, maybe the biggest director of all time. I could say he could be. You know, he had clearly made Jaws in 1975. And Universal Studios was like, well, we're going to sue New World. Because they knew there's no way in the world New World Pictures could have absorbed any kind of big lawsuit. They couldn't do it. They just didn't have the money for that. So what happened was Steven Spielberg was able to see the movie in advance, and he absolutely loved it. And he said, no, don't sue them. Drop that lawsuit, because this is a very well-made movie. Yes, it's going to piggyback on some of our success, but it's not going to take our money away from us. And I think I think that shows something, though, too, about great directors and stuff and people who truly love film. A studio is trying to make money. I get that. I totally do. You see that, you know, with small companies. I'm thinking like New Line Cinema, you know, those small companies that became big ones and stuff like that. They're trying to make money, and sometimes you got to ape off of what's there. Nowadays, like I think of the Asylum. Now, before Sharknadoes, yes, there's four of them. Number four is coming out July 31st, 2016. If you're listening to this, it's going to drop before it. You should watch it because they're funny as all get out. Before that, the Asylum used to make basically rip-off movies. They made, like, there was Snakes on a Plane. Well, they made Snakes on a Train. And then you had, like, you know, there's a movie about a giant crocodile. It was like Lake Placid. Well, they made, you know, whatever. And then they started realizing they could start making these versus movies and stuff, and they do the exact same thing. Now, a couple funny things here. Roger Corman, again, he called this his homage to Jaws. He was really good at getting the most bang for his buck, and while certain things were kind of expensive, he definitely knew he needed to get top-rate effects people. Now, originally, Rick Baker, yes, that Rick Baker, was supposed to be doing the effects, but he couldn't do it because of whatever constraints he had. And he suggested that he hire a makeup artist by the name of Rob Bottin. Now, 17-year-old Rob Bottin. Now, that's a name, of course. Rob Bottin, a very, very influential effects artist. John Carpenter's The Thing. And then this was also Phil Tippett was involved in this makeup as well. Okay. The bobbing corpse that you'll see in the climactic Prina attack is actually modeled after Rob Bottin. So, also, Barbara Steele's in this. Now, Barbara Steele, for those of you who are Hammer fans, you clearly know who Barbara Steele is. You don't have to be a Hammer fan to know Barbara Steele. But if you're a Hammer fan, you know who Barbara Steele is. Barbara Steele's stuff goes back. If you listen to old Vault episodes before I was on, they talked about, Mario Bava stuff. I mean, Barbara Steele, just a great actress. And again, at the end of her career, I think of this like the same way with McCarthy and stuff. They made movies. This is now the end of his career. John Saxon made movies like this. I'm thinking Black Christmas. I'm thinking like Nightmare on Elm Street. Things along those lines where you see actors near the end of their careers making a film. They're not in it a ton. One of the things that does come up in here is that we learn that Barbara Steele's character and Kevin McCarthy's character are actually were lovers at one point, and you're thinking like, way to go, Kevin, you know, kind of thing. But just funny things are along there. Now, if you're looking to purchase Piranha, I'm gonna tell you right now, there's the only disc that I know of. I had a bootleg copy that I got years and years ago, but it was obviously on tape and stuff. The Roger Corman's Cult Classics. That's the DVD version is $7.13. Kind of ironic as this is dropping on that date, but doesn't matter. It's $7.13 on DVD. I own that. I actually pre-ordered that back in the day. This is before I had Blu-ray and stuff. I actually own the Blu-ray. I was able to get that on a sale that Amazon was running. It's currently $17.52. I think I got mine for $9. The DVD is gorgeous. Has all the special features. The Blu-ray's great, too. A reversible cover. All great stuff. If you're going to purchase this, folks, I'm asking you to go to the Two True Freaks website. Click on that Amazon link like I do for everything I purchase. I'm not just joking here. If you're ever on the boards and you see, stuff gets posted like, what are our listeners are buying? It's mostly stuff I'm buying. So go do that. Now, the one thing you got to watch out for, and this is something that happened. There was a remake in 1995, which was, I think they were done for Showtime. I could be wrong, but I know they did Humanoids of the Deep, and they did a couple other of these Roger Corman classics. Now, that's from 1995. That was, it's not horrible. I own it, but I'm saying but it's definitely not the movie you're looking for here. There is a sequel called Piranha 2 The Spawning, and if you thought it was cool they had Joe Dante directing this one, how about the man who brought you Avatar and Titanic? Yes, James Cameron directed the Piranha 2 the Spawning. I'm hard pressed for anyone to say that, and he also did Terminator 2 and everything else that James Cameron did. I'm hard pressed to watching Spawning, Piranha 2 the Spawning, to say, this guy, he could be one of the biggest directors of all time. There's also the 2010, I think it's 2010 remake that was in 3D. Now, that's Alexandre Aja. For those of you who don't know Alexandre Aja, the movie he got famous for was Haute Tension. which is a French movie, which is High Tension. And he went on to direct other movies in the horror genre. He's one of my favorite young directors. When his name's attached to something, I'm willing to give it a shot because I know he doesn't make schlock. The remake, the 2010 remake of Piranha, is hysterical. Ving Rhames is great. Elizabeth Shue plays the sheriff. Is one of the Connell brothers. I think it's Jerry Connell. He doesn't have a great death in that movie. But yeah. So, but he dies. And sorry if I'm giving anything away there, but trust me, when you see it, you won't be mad at me. You'll just laugh. The piranha in that movie are way more souped up than the piranha here. There was Richard Dreyfuss is in that. It's just, you have to see it if you enjoy those kind of movies. I saw it at home. I didn't bother seeing it in the theater in 3D. There's actually a sequel to that called Piranha 3DD, or 3DD, I guess that's because the young lady on the cover is well endowed there, and that's what they're playing off of. And that's kind of really silly. That's at a water park, and that's got David Hasselhoff in it. And I know you're saying is, Jay, that sounds horrible. My wife and I watched it. It's funny. That's the whole point. Anyway, so if you want to see these movies, and again, it's available, go right to the Two True Freaks website. Go right through the link, the Amazon link. Hit it up. I'm sure it's available. I mean, it might be available. It used to be available on Netflix. I don't know if it still is. But I'll be honest with you, folks. It's worth the time to do it. Now, we have a few pieces of email here. A couple pieces of email I want to read and respond to, and then actually a piece of email that was forwarded to me that we need to talk about as well. The first one says, comments on them and the podcast in general. This is from Adam Tebolt. Now, Adam and I are friends, but he's friends with my brother. We became friends because of that. It says, greetings, Jay. I finally subscribed to your podcast 3 episodes in. I especially enjoyed the episode for them, since it's a movie I've only ever seen bits and pieces of. Your podcast inspired me to grab it on DVD and watch it all the way through for the first time. I have to say, I was really impressed. I first realized I was watching a quality film when the scene at the beginning with the little girl wandering the desert, clutching her doll, started up. My dad's senses went into overdrive, and I was filled with anxiety for the poor little girl. I was amazed at how effective the scene was. Anyway, thanks for the push to watch such a great movie. I have The Beast and 29 Fathoms queued up and prepared for the next episode. Keep watching the skies, Adam. Now, Adam does have a little daughter. She's younger than my daughter. She's a cutie pie, by the way. My daughter's a cutie pie, too, but his daughter's very cute. And I agree with Adam. It's that scene, and I think Dad and I talked about that. That scene, that little girl, she doesn't say much, and she's not in the movie very long, but man, is she powerful. That little girl steals that, and it aches your heart, especially when you become a parent. I mean, you don't have to be a parent. You have to just kind of sympathize for her. But even more when you have a little daughter, I could just imagine my little daughter having gone through something traumatic and, you know, and clutching her doll. Her doll is named Dakota. It's a Cabbage Patch Kid, an original, that she brings everywhere. I can just imagine her clutching her doll and just staring off in that wide-eyed and, like, you know, being completely shocked and terrified. Thank you for the letter, Adam. Adam's a, you know, normal contributor to things. He's always got stuff to say. He's one of the guys who, again, he likes the kind of stuff my brother and I, Luke's friends with him, obviously, in the really real world kind of thing. We all kind of talk about this kind of stuff. So the second email I have here is from none other than my brother. It says, episode 3, out of primordial depths to destroy the world. It says, Jay and Dad. Well, clearly Dad's not here, so he'll have to listen on the podcast. Hey there, wanted to drop you a quick line about episode 3 of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, talking about It Came From Beneath the Sea. As a kid who dug sea monsters, naturally, this one was always one of my favorites. The pace is deliberate and story is straightforward, much like many of his contemporaries, but once the action starts, it really picks up. Let me just hang it right there. Dad talks about this. He talks about the idea of the documentary film styling they used in Them, or even that It Came From Beneath the Sea, like mixing in the kind of it's stock footage in It Came From Beneath the Sea of the military, but it's told, it's like, we're telling you, it's not like this is fantastic and you're jumping around, like you're learning with the audience, which is great. The octopus, or in this case sectopus, is not one of the more monstrous designs, but the advantage of a cephalopod, excuse me, like that is that it already looks weird, so making it a giant one is reasonable for a monster. Heck, Toho used the giant octopus Okodo in the 1960s, which is, in my mind, was always a spiritual successor to it. Now, that before I go on, what Luke's talking about, obviously he's referring to Toho here, and then that's the giant octopus that Kong fights on the island. I felt so. You watch that, and my daughter's like, "Is that a real octopus?" When we watched the King Kong, Godzilla versus King Kong, and I was like, "Yeah, it's a real octopus." And then they have a faked octopus and stuff like that. It's a whole thing. Listen to Luke's podcast. If you're not listening to my brother's podcast, you got to go back and listen because he hits all that stuff. To me, the iconic image. We're back to the email. To me, the iconic image of this film is always the flamethrowers being used to drive back the tentacles. From a technical standpoint, it's a great composition of multiple elements, and it always tangentially reminds me of the dragon's fire breath in the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. The use of a flamethrower is also very wonderful 50s to me, which, like we, much like we saw with the use of flamethrowers in Them, and he's on point there. When they use the flamethrowers to drive back the tentacles, it's a great scene. It's very effective. No one's there going, I wonder why the tentacles are moving. It's a flamethrower. You know why the tentacles are moving away. Back to the email. It's interesting, looking back at it now, that Ray Harryhausen never made a film set in the future. They were either set in the modern day or set in history, either recent or ancient. The modern day films shared similarities with other films of the era. When you get that right down to it, The Beast Between the Fathoms, It Came From Beneath the Sea, 20 Million Miles to Earth, The Valley of Guanji, are Monsters on the Loose movies, and Earth vs. the Flying Saucers is an alien invasion picture, both of which were common genre fare. But Harryhausen's effects, along with Charles Schneer's direct and Harryhausen's indirect influence over production, meant that quality and care was built into the production of the, from the start. I think that goes without saying. Lucas hit the nail right in the head there. He continues, the elements which unite these modern-day Harryhausen films from me is the unknown. Rather than a normal animal mutated by atomic radiation like in Them, Tarantula, or Beginning of the End, Harryhausen ones dealt with focus on which were from some elements which was alien to man, whether it be from the bottom of the ocean, the prehistoric world, or outer space. As his career progressed, it became clear that he preferred to work with the ancient world as he saw in The Golden Age, Eye of the Tiger, and Clash of the Titans, and would have seen in The Force of the Trojans. But I still enjoy these modern films. Oh, okay. But I still enjoy these modern films in which the same way I like films like Godzilla or Pal's War of the Worlds, with the unknown being deftly inserted into reality. It Came From Beneath the Sea is no different, and as a B-movie, it delivers on all promises and then some. Thanks for the show, Luke. Now, Luke really hits on there. I mean, clearly, there are Harryhausen fans out there who are fans. Maybe they enjoy his you know, the Monsters on the Loose kind of movies, but they're really fans of like Seventh Voyage of Sinbad or Golden Voyage of Sinbad or Jason and the Argonauts, like that, those kind of movies. And then there's other fans that, again, I don't think I've ever met anybody who doesn't like those, but I'm saying, but maybe they were fans of his because of the other ones. And we get to be, you know, my brother and I clearly are influenced by my dad. My dad's a huge Harryhausen fan, and we grew up with that. To us, that's the norm, and that's the way things were. And part of the, I shouldn't say issue, but part of what we grew up, you know, knowing is that how things were made and how, you know, we learned about how Harryhausen did stop motion animation. We read, you know, books on it, the Film Fantasy Scrapbook that we talk about, that had a lot of information on there too. What we were doing was we were learning about all the different things that went into making these movies and how these creatures were done, and you know, and it gives you a better appreciation, I think, sometimes when you understand that, you know, the craftsmanship that goes into it. It wasn't just slapdash in a page. And Luke brings up a good point there. In the Day the World Ended or Beginning of the End or things like that, where they just had giant superimposed monster, you know, animals on. I think Tarantula's a perfect example of this. Those are a little less effective, I think, than when you see stop-motion animation. And I'm a huge fan of stop-motion animation. I'm a huge fan of physical effects. I always love it. I know that clearly digital effects have their place, and I'm not completely going to poo-poo digital effects, but I think when we can see physical effects in something, it gives you a sense of weight and realism that a truly digital effect can't do. Now, I'm not saying that you couldn't have that, but let's be honest here, folks. I think that when you watch a Godzilla movie and you see two men in suits stomping around on a set, whether you think that's, you know, you kind of like, oh, it's, and you're laughing at it, or you take it seriously like we do, you know that there's physical action going on, something's physically there. If that was all just digital, you kind of would look, when it didn't have weight to it, you kind of tell that. But it's just one of those things, ladies and gentlemen, that I think sometimes is lost when we start seeing movies where they clearly don't care about, you know, just throwing the effects up on the screen. I know that there are movies that were made for lots and lots and lots of money that took a lot of care. I'm thinking of the Lord of the Rings series and how much he was able to get out of those movies. How much is on the screen, and you're like, how much did this cost? Well, it looks like it cost three times as much. Why? Because Peter Jackson loved movies, and he knew what he was doing, and he had the effects. He had Weta Studios behind him, and he shot this stuff over in New Zealand where, things are cheaper, and he got the most bang for his buck. And then sometimes you see big movies come out, and you're like, wow, it's got a big star now. That's another big star. Okay, well, this thing had a $300 million, budget, and you're like, ugh, and it falls flat, and it just doesn't have what you need. And I'm not looking to, bash anyone's work, but to be honest, there are movies that we see that just don't hold up. And I think some of that has to do with why are you making the movie? Are you making the movie because you're going to make a lot of money with it? Are you making the movie because you want to tell the story? Are you doing it because you love the movie? Whatever it might be. So the one last thing I wanted to talk about here today, and this was actually an email sent to Luke it was from Tim Elliott. Tim Elliott's a great supporter of the network, a great supporter of our show. You can hear him on, what the heck is his name? It's the Burn one. I'll fix it in post. Unlike some people, I actually went back in post. Tim Elliott is the host of Third Degree Burn, which you can hear on the Two True Freaks Network. Now, back to our podcast. He actually sent my brother an email, and when Luke covered this email in episode number 47. That's the one that came out, I think, June 28th of this year, 2016. If you haven't listened to that episode, go right now and listen to episode number 47 of Earth Destruction Directive. It came out June 28th, 2016. So go do that right now. I'll wait. Oh, good. You're back. So now that you've listened to what Luke had to say and then the email talks about here, and I'll skip down to the part that my real reason for writing in was because you and Jason spent so much time talking about the Von Erich wrestling. I grew up in Denton, Texas, and the Von Erichs lived just a few miles south in Shady Shores. My cousin even went to high school with Kerry. I never really followed wrestling when I was young, but I would catch Fritz on Friday night wrestling on our local station before the late movie. When I worked at Walmart, Fritz would come in all the time and have his truck serviced, and you would see Kerry and Kevin from time to time at Chili's or Kruger's around Denton. I don't follow myself, but why do so many comic book fans I know also follow wrestling? Do wrestlers feel a desire to see men and women dress up in colorful costumes and battle for dominance, or real-life superheroes and villains? Okay, enough of our armchair psychology. Keep the shows coming. And Luke, you and Jason attend the reunion, yada, yada. He puts, I'm really digging Bots, Bugs, and Babe. Tim Elliott also wrote my favorite email ever to The Vault, where he put me over about how great my artwork is. Anytime you want to write in about that, Tim, I will gladly put you over on the show. Anyway, so to the crux of the question, and I wanted to make sure I hit this on a show that I know Tim listens to. I know he enjoys Bots, Bugs, and Babes, as many of you do. Why do comic book fans and wrestling fans cross over? I think Luke covered that really well. Here's my take on it. As someone who's not a comic book fan, and I think that's part of the big thing, is I'm not a comic book fan in the way that necessarily a lot of you guys, if you are, members of the network or whatever it might be, out there are fans. When I grew up, my favorite comic book character was Batman. And a lot of you are saying, well, I like Batman. And I like Batman pretty much because he didn't have any power and he kind of, and he's tough and stuff like that. And I know there's some Batman stories get out there. But my other favorite comic book character was the Punisher. And when I was little, I liked Thor a little bit because I thought he was really cool and he had blonde hair and he's a big muscle guy and whatever. But I kind of like those kind of characters. I like those kind of comic book characters. So when you look at the wrestling that I liked, and I was a much bigger wrestling fan than comic book fan ever, to me, I always looked at wrestling as the physicality of it was always something that when I was younger, having a younger brother who's, 2 years younger than me, we would wrestle all the time. I mean, we'd be living heck of it. We would always try to protect each other. We tried to learn how to do moves and not hurt each other. But there's always a time when Luke decided to jump off the, whatever and land double knees to my back. And it's the first time my back ever cracked and I thought he broke my spine. Or the time I went to, do whatever, and Luke and I managed to slam our skulls together and almost knock ourselves unconscious. Things like that. That's just part of the physicality of being, a boy and having a young, having a brother or whatever, that roughhouse kind of play. And to me, wrestling was always just one of those things where these guys were bigger than life, and You know, I might not have been a big Superman fan or a big, Spider-Man fan or the Hulk or any of those people, but I definitely watched all those cartoons and stuff. It was just part of what it was. To me, wrestling was just another aspect of that. As a fan of American Gladiators growing up too, it just was another aspect of it to see this normal person be able to get in there. Because not every wrestler back in the day, if you only watched WWF back in the 80s, then every single person was huge. But if you watched the NWA back in the 80s, there are people of different sizes and shapes and whatever. And you could see that, you know, you can connect with that. And I think that comes out too. And we've seen this in the last, and again, I know I'm yammering about wrestling here. When you started seeing individuals like CM Punk and Bryan Danielson and those kind of guys who were small, those guys who could walk around with you and you'd never notice them. When you started seeing them become successful, people started like, I can identify, that could be me. I could be that successful guy. To me, wrestling always was just part of what it meant to do this kind of stuff that you did as a kid. Like, I never thought about there being any connection between that and superheroes, especially since a lot of the comic books that, I mean, those comic books were dead. I mean, I read G.I. Joe, which again is, you know, completely, you know, fantasy compared to like the real, you know, the really real world, but it's certainly not anything. It's not like the Hulk or Fantastic Four or something like that. But I also read a lot of the EC reprints. I was a big Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, you know, the Haunt of Fear. That's the kind of stuff I read. I read the Dark Horse Predator stuff. It had a tie into things I was into. And I think, you know, some people get hooked on wrestling and some people get hooked on wrestling when they're young and walk away from it. And that's cool. And I don't have a problem with that. I know that my daughter loves wrestling. She loves wrestling. She thinks John Cena is like the greatest person in the world. But she also knows that it's you know, that the outcomes are predetermined, but she still gets invested in it, but she knows that it can be very dangerous and stuff like that. But she also, that's why when she watches movies, she sat here and watched Piranha with me and my wife, and I said to my wife, I said, well, there's a couple of scenes where you're going to see some tops off, and Kelly's like, all right, we'll just kind of just cover our eyes at that point. And my daughter's like, Daddy, I know what that stuff is, you know, kind of thing. I was like, all right, but we still don't want you seeing it. And, you know, I mean, she's heard a bad word here and there, and, you know, God forbid, you know, anyone drops a bad word. If you heard The Vault, you know I drop a few of them. But when she's watching Piranha, she's not scared. She's not scared of going in the water. She's like, wow, how'd they do that? That's the first thing she had. How'd they do that? How'd they make the fishies do that? I said, well, those aren't real fish. They're piranha like this. And I explained to her how it's done. She goes, oh, and now she's thinking is, can we make one of those? Can we make a rubber fish on a stick and we can pretend like it's eating people? Because she's into that stuff. And I think that's really what it comes down to. Our dad, you know, he never forced any of this stuff on us. It was just what was readily available. And wrestling was one of those things at the time was not always readily available. And WF at the time. Hulk Hogan was bigger than life. I mean, it was hard to be a kid in the 80s and not know who Hulk Hogan was. Like, it was hard to be a kid in the 80s and not know who Freddy Krueger was. Right? You know, everyone knew who the president was, Ronald Reagan. Like, I knew that stuff. It's just because that was the 80s. There wasn't information constantly streaming into you 24/7, you know, through your phone or through your watch or through your TV or whatever. So you only had, when we grew up, we only had 6 channels. I mean, it was, you know, well, no, like, I mean, we, on a good day when it was clear, Channel 8 came in, and that usually carried what Channel 7 had, except the times when it didn't. And that's when you get a Thompson Twins concert at 3 in the morning, which was really cool. But that's what it is, folks. I mean, it's not, I can't say that, yes, there's a clear, you know, whatever. Maybe to some people it is. Maybe to some people, the wrestlers represent the superhero. They represent the guy who's bigger than life, the guy who's muscular, the guy who's whatever it might be, or the girl. It could be the women, too, although women's wrestling really has grown in the last few years compared to what it used to be when it was just kind of a sideshow attraction kind of thing. Sorry to say, but that's the reality of life of women's wrestling back in the day. So maybe that's what it is. I wish I had a better answer for you, Tim. All I can tell you is, yeah, I'm kind of really jealous that you might have actually got to meet Kerry Von Erich, one of my favorite wrestlers of all time. And Kevin. I love Kevin, too, but Kevin's still with us. Kerry, unfortunately, did pass away. And as long as many, the tragedy of the Von Erichs is well documented in several different documentaries. If you didn't know about it, go watch it. You'll cry. I cried. I knew what was happening. I knew what was coming. And I still wound up crying my eyes out. So, like I said, Tim, I wish I had a better, like, concrete, like, yes, this is the answer. But then again, if I had concrete answers to everything, I'd be able to, like, be rich and wear a cape and be a superhero myself. No, just joking. Anyway, so thank you very much, Tim, for sending that to Luke. And Luke, thank you for sending that to me and let me spout off here at the end of the episode where things tend to go a little more off of base than where we are. Just want to let you know, folks, this one's dropping in July in a few weeks. Jersey Fest is right around the corner. Again, if you're still interested in Jersey Fest, go to www.jerseyfestfair.com. Check out Jersey Fest. It's 3 days of the most awesome stuff going on. They just added a sculpting party. Now, we have what's called a show and tell Saturday night where we kind of sit around and talk about, it's usually with other artists and stuff like that. We talk about how we painted things and techniques and stuff like that. The sculpting party right now, it's being promoted as, it's going to be Friday night for anybody attending the show. So even if you're going to the show and you didn't, you know, let's say do the classes, I'm sure if they let you, you can buy tickets and whatever early, if you're going to be attending the show, it's a chance to sit down and talk sculpting. Now, supposedly Casey Love is going to be at the sculpting party, along with Randy Bowen. Randy Bowen is teaching the sculpting course. Still amazing to me. You know, you're sculpting a Hulk with Randy Bowen. That would be insane. I'm taking the course where I'm painting with Casey Love. Casey is arguably one of my favorite artists of all time. Very influential in my life. And that's just having spoken to him the couple times I have and watching his DVDs and techniques and stuff. So, like I said, Jersey Fest coming up at the end of August. There'll be another episode drop between there and there, and I'll hype it then there too. But if you're interested in modeling, in special effects, all that stuff, if you're interested in statues, this has got a great statue show. You want to talk about, you know, being able to get some stuff you haven't seen in a long time. There are going to be guys there with stuff. It's just awesome. So, anyway, folks, I've rambled enough for now. So, let me tell you what's coming up next, because everyone's like, what's coming up next? Well, We have been talking about Harryhausen and stuff, and there's a movie that a lot of people think Ray Harryhausen did the special effects for, and that movie's called The Black Scorpion, but it wasn't Ray Harryhausen. It was a man named Willis O'Brien. You're like, Willis O'Brien? I know that name. You should. He did King Kong. Willis O'Brien did the effects for The Black Scorpion. I know on Misty, when they Mistied The Black Scorpion, they kind of make that joke in there that, like, they say it's a Ray Harryhausen movie, and then Joel comes out and says, actually, it's Willis O'Brien. Right? The whole point is, that's the next one. Dad should be back for that one because he loves The Black Scorpion. Black Scorpion was one of those movies we had on an old tape boot. You used to go in the back of the they would send you the entire month of what was going to be on cable because you could program that at that time. And you go in the back, and you buy the illegal black boxes and the place you could buy movies you couldn't get anywhere else. And we had things like that. One of the movies was Black Scorpion. So that's up next. Dad should be on for that one. It'll be a lot of fun. If you got anything you want to talk to me about, you don't like what I said today, which is, again, you're entitled to that opinion, shoot me an email. And obviously, folks, I want to do, I want to talk about the stuff you're into. And if you're into talking about what we just were talking about today, you want to talk about episodes that happened already. If you have questions, about other stuff, which is fine. I'm gladly answering for you. So if you're interested in shooting me, it's botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. You can shoot that right to me. And I will gladly answer emails. I will gladly, not just that, I will gladly read them on the air if they're they make sense of what we're talking about. And if you have any suggestions or anything like that, I'll gladly welcome all that feedback. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for giving me your time. Thank you for supporting the show. Thank you for supporting the network. Again, none of us are getting paid for this. This is all just a labor of love. And the one thing we know is that we do this because we enjoy doing this. I love talking about, horror movies and different things like that. But I also know that it's important that if I'm not, if you guys didn't want to hear this stuff, even if I want to yabber about it, I wouldn't be here. Thank you for the support. Thank you for the downloads. Thank you for doing what needs to be done. And, we here, all of us here, do this because we love doing this. So, like I said, next, thank you very much. Next month, we're doing Black Scorpion. So if you want to watch it before you listen, there it is. Let's keep those cards and letters coming and keep watching the skies.
In the movie Piranha, the first thing where they were in the pond, and they were, and two people jumped in and they got eaten alive. Then they went through the tube, and then they went to the river. And then people got eaten there too. And then they went to the lake. And a lot of people got eaten. And people, if you watch that movie and you hear me on saying this, don't yell at the screen like I did. Bye. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I caught a piranha alive. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I let it go again. Why did I let it go? Because it ate all my fingers and toes.
Good job. I love you.
Love you too, Daddy.
So, folks, I wanted to have this be separate than the actual podcast and just have his own little thing here at the end. About the time I was recording this episode, actually a few days prior, we found out that one of my dear friends and former student, she was my former student and someone I love very, very much. She was a really great young lady, lost her battle to cancer at the age of 25. And it's hard being a parent who has lost a child. My son passed away almost 7 years ago, for a parent to ever have to lose a child. And I know that I sometimes on the network sound kind of like I joke around and whatever, but it is one of those things that I carry with me, and it's one of those things that I know this family now carries with them, especially since I know this family. I've known them for years. I've known all the brothers and stuff like that. I just wanted to say that take time to make sure you tell the people you love that you love them, because once they're gone, they're gone, and it hurts when they're gone, but you have the time now. Don't ever put off today, don't put off to tomorrow what you could do today. Don't say, oh, I'll just call that person, whatever. They're going to be gone. And I know a lot of people have dealt with cancer in many different forms. In fact, I'm hard pressed to find a person who hasn't in some way had something in their life, cancer touched something in their lives. I mean, we've had to deal with in my own family as well, people passing away, people having, survived and stuff like that. But I just wanted to say that, to the young lady, Amanda Benaway, who was a very good friend of mine, someone I love dearly, and I knew she loved my daughter to pieces, that we'll miss you, we love you, and that there's no way that you'll ever be anywhere but in our hearts and looking down on us. So,
this is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?